Hello, welcome and thank you for joining us and listening to our podcast, The God Beyond the Bible. Our podcast is released weekly each Friday. The content of each episode is based on the questions and curiosities we all have about God and the Bible. Many of our topics are considered taboo in the minds of the mainstream church. You will find our discussions to be, I think, refreshing and often far from traditional. But we don't just skirt around these complex issues, but confront them head on, and not in the way you're used to hearing them discussed on typical Christian talk shows. I'm Alan Rowland, creator and host of The God Beyond the Bible. As of the launch of this podcast, I've been a pastor for more than 35 years. My co-host is my daughter, Trayson, and our engineer co-producer is my daughter, Tabitha. Our mission is to encourage our audience, along with us, to open our minds to the reality that God is simply too big to be fully explored or experienced by the reading and studying of a single ancient work. In short, the Bible's not the sum of God, and to think this is to limit what He has done, is doing, and what He will do in our future. So with introductions made, thank you for listening, and let's dive into the topic of the day. Hello, friends, believers, seekers, skeptics, and yes, even antagonizers, if that word means what I think it means. If not, nix that last one. Welcome to the podcast, God Beyond the Bible, the podcast designed by seekers and for seekers. This is episode number 60 and should release around or about March 27th, 2020, the year of our Lord. How about shout-outs this week?
Our shout-outs this week are to Jessica, Angie, and Paul. And, of course, always to Charles.
Isn't that a 70s musical group?
Jessica, Angie, and Paul.
Yeah. Oh, no, that was Peter, Paul, and Mary, wasn't it? Okay. Well, we're off together. Well, it should have been. That should be a music. You guys ought to form a group there. What about our quote, Tab?
Okay, our quote is, this is from Wayne Dyer. He said, peace is the result of retraining your mind to process life as it is, rather than as you think it should be.
I like that.
That's good. That's really good. Well, what was last episode? Number 59? And it was a discussion that was actually prompted by the previous episode, which would have been 48. 58, you mathematicians, which was on the silent period. Where did I get 48? Tracing is that catching, whatever she's from. Okay. Our discussion was prompted by a previous episode, number 58, which was on the silent period. That is some 400-year period between the Old and New Testament. Last week, we more or less wondered what we might dub this past 2,000 years, where, as far as the Bible goes, God has once again been silent. Well, the truth is, as we learned, God was anything but silent in that 400-year period. Someone just decided for us that it wasn't going to be part of the Bible, even though there were two books, the books of the Maccabees. I think in the past year and a half of podcast, we've pretty well established our position on limiting God to what man has determined to be worthy of spiritual preservation, and placing titles like authorized on it as though God himself was doing the authorizing. Mm-hmm.
So this week, we want to open up our minds and to a topic that has been a driving force behind much activity and is probably the single most prominent driving force in the organized church for the past couple hundred years. And it is the topic of salvation.
All right, so let's dive into segment one. Let's start here by trying to nail down a definition of this concept that has dominated the minds and message of the modern pulpit, especially amongst those labeled evangelicals. In short, salvation indicates that one is to be saved. To be saved indicates one is to be preserved or spared from someone or something which presents a clear and imminent danger.
Our first task is to clear up exactly what or who it is that is presenting this danger or threat to our safety. And that may vary depending on who you ask or what brand of Christianity we're receiving our information from. Before we go too deep into this part of the topic, let's point out the fact that any time someone comes warning us of some future imminent threat, it triggers a reaction in us. It's called self-preservation.
Mm-hmm. So just for a moment, let's steer the salvation topic away from the spiritual and place it in the natural so that we can examine the psychology behind this concept. Since we live in Arkansas and it is springtime, we have a fairly constant threat that we all live with daily, and it is the weather, namely tornadoes. There are times when that threat is very real and imminent, meaning that the conditions are right, and usually means that we're in a period of heavy thunderstorms and possibly a tornado or two has already been reported.
We went through that just the other night,
didn't we? I started to say,
that's pretty familiar to us because we all gathered at the Friday ho.
We did.
The other night.
For those of y'all who don't live in Tornado Alley, it usually works something like this. The weather conditions are right. Our local state weather bureau will put out an alert, often in the form of a tornado watch, which means that conditions are right for a twister. As the storm system progresses, there'll be a warning for a particular county, city, or area. Now, when we see or hear this, we become a little more alert, depending on where the warning is and which direction it's moving. So let's suppose that the warning is for our county and community, and there's a report of a tornado on the ground and moving in our direction. Now, the threat has become real and imminent. We're in danger.
Mm-hmm. So what is our natural psychological response to this situation? Nervousness, tension, fear, elevated alertness. All these are self-preservation responses. In this scenario, one would be well advised to practice self-preservation and seek safety. Okay, so we seek safety. In this area, we call it, it's some concrete reinforced shelter here. And in the hills, we call it a cellar. Mm-hmm. Storm, or more sophisticated term might be a storm shelter, and we have safe, or we don't particularly, but there's people who have safe rooms and basements, and so we seek refuge in one of these safe places.
Right. Now let's say that by heeding the warning, we seek safety, and the tornado actually does hit our neighborhood, and everyone in the neighborhood survives. That is basically a natural salvation. Mm-hmm. A clear danger, a warning, the warning is heeded, a safe place is sought out, the threat passes, and we survived.
And whether your natural threat is tornadoes, hurricanes, tsunamis, earthquakes, or
who spelled that on the script?
I wonder.
Go ahead.
This scenario is pretty much the same. A threat, a warning, self-preservation kicks in, a method of obtaining safety, the method is successful, we're saved. And the degree to which we feel like we were spared or saved is usually based on the degree of the destruction when we emerge from our safety.
So, clearly, in the natural, salvation is pretty much cut and dried. All depending on a lot of factors, of course, and how we react and respond, and sometimes on the planning and the preparation we put into the whole thing.
So, when we remove all this from the natural, however, and we place it in the spiritual sense, that's when things get a little complicated. And the source and level of the imminent threat is dependent on how we perceive God. So with that thought, allow us to pause, regroup, and we'll return in just a minute and continue with episode 60 of God Beyond the Bible.
All right, and let's dive right back into segment two. Let's continue with our last thought on the topic of salvation. We made our best attempt to define salvation in the natural sense with our tornado scenario, and we ended with the idea of converting that same concept into a spiritual danger or threat. Do you think it's fair to approach this topic from this angle? After all, that's what evangelizing has pretty much become, hasn't it?
I think it has. Mm-hmm. That's my interpretation. Yeah.
The sounding of a warning of a danger or threat, self-preservation is aroused, and safety is sought. Mm-hmm.
Now, let's try to the best of our ability to break this down. First of all, if there is a threat, what is it and what is its source? I guess the threat from which we need to be saved is hell. I mean, depending on who you are and where you come from, we're just trying to break this down in our minds. I guess the threat from which we need to be saved is hell. Is that a fair cut to the chase answer? And of course, it's not our natural physical life that is in peril, but our soul or our spirit.
Okay, so before we go any farther, let's consider for a moment in our modern Christian movement, this is pretty much our basis for promoting a belief in God and His Son, Jesus Christ. I mean, right?
Right.
Yeah.
We're not being condescending or trying to offend anyone in the modern Christian movement of which we are a part of. We must ask ourselves these questions and be able, not from a rehearsed set of answers, but from our own personal heart, be able to answer these hard questions.
It's hard to separate the two.
It is.
Because it's almost programmed into us. Why we're doing this, we never really ask it for ourselves. Okay, Tracy, I think you're next.
Moving ahead, our spirit or soul, depending on who you ask, is in peril. There's a clear and present danger of this part of us that the best we can identify is our consciousness of our own selves that we know as who we are.
Right.
It's going to live beyond this natural life. In other words, we will be conscious and thinking beings outside of our physical body.
Now, that part of it, I'm totally with. I think there's more. I just know. I just know in my spirit there's much more. We're not these conscious thinking beings that are just going to disappear, that our consciousness dies with our, I believe that, well, we'll go on and we'll get to that. But anyway, so that's the idea. There's something in us. There's something about us. Our consciousness of who we are is going to live past this present life. Okay. The threat or danger is that our conscious soul or spirit is automatically, not contingent upon any action or decision of our own, bound for a bad experience upon death. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it is.
Is it of our thought process in the Christian movement, evangelistic movement? In other words, without our spiritual self-preservation kicking in and us seeking a place of safety, when we die, it is literally hell to pay. Is that a fair description of what salvation is based on?
I mean, it is. And it sounds really harsh. And I've never really... I mean, I have in the last, but before I've never really put it down and looked at it that way. But I mean, it is.
But is it really any different than...
I'm literally not saying anything that I haven't heard evangelists say directly from the pulpit either.
Well, I started to say there's this really big movement going on right now within the evangelical society that, you know, hell is still hot. Their big quote that they're... And we need to remember that, and we need to be saving people because... Hell is still hot.
And this hellboundness of every person is based on the concept of our ancestor Adam having made the wrong decision in the garden. He passed this automatic sentence of punishment down to everyone who would share his genetic makeup throughout all existence of mankind.
Okay, now let's be honest. If we understand it correctly, there is no reason for anyone in the evangelical circle to be offended, because this is the very foundation of the promotion of the salvation message and the fundamental basis for doing church, is it not?
That's the way I understand it.
Okay, so let's pause a moment here and ask an important question. In this scenario, who is the source of our peril? Is it Adam? Is Adam in this place that we call hell? I mean, we're told he's not because God saved him. Then you have to ask exactly where, when, and how did this happen? You can be assured of getting as many different answers to that question as the number of people that you ask.
And I can guarantee you, they're all not basing it on anything concrete because... I've read that book.
Well, and others will tell us that the source of our peril is the serpent or the devil or Satan. That is Adam's choice. That it is Adam's choice to listen to him.
Or was, instead, whatever. Yeah,
right. I'm sorry. Instead of God that has brought us into our perilous situation. Then one has to ask, who or what is this force? If he is a contender with God, and he already existed before God made Adam, and is God's arch enemy, he persuaded Adam to make a choice contrary to God's instruction, a choice that we might add was placed before him sort of like a test, then didn't that make Adam just a pawn or a test instrument in some supernatural contest or conflict?
Well, we hesitate to say, but that's what that scenario sounds
exactly
like.
That's exactly what it is.
Well, and some scholars and theologians believe that this is exactly the case, that it's really not about us as the human race at all, but it's about settling this supernatural conflict. But doesn't that make us innocent collateral damage of a war?
You know, and I used to say that a lot. I used to say, well, it's about the end game. It's about what's going to happen at the end when God rules. And then I felt, because I understood that I was merely just a pawn. And do I really think that God cares about me if I'm just a pawn in his game?
If you're and we're not going to bring politics or political things into this, but this is basically what, if this is some kind of conflict, supernatural conflict, then we don't really have any way of knowing what role it is that we're playing in all of this.
And I'm just going to take it a bit farther. You know, just on my personal, doesn't it seem a little bit unfair that we're all caught up in this sort of war, and because of a decision that Adam made 4,000 years ago, that I'm going to have to go to hell for
that? I almost feel
like
we've been drafted into something that we don't want to.
And I can give you the pat answer. But that's all it's going to be. It's just going to be the answer we've been programmed to give for that. Because if you ask the question, I can just about tell you the answer you're going to get from the evangelistic community. Am I number eight?
You are.
Now we will ask the really difficult question, but it is legitimate and it needs to be asked more in the church culture. Is it God that we need to be saved from?
I think I heard all the collective air come out of the room.
Is he the source of our peril? We do say that he is angry over our fallen state and has sentenced all mankind to hell. And then we say that it is he who saves us through Christ's sacrifice on the cross. Without sounding heretical.
Too late.
Yeah, probably too late for that. Is God saving us from himself? Is it just us? Or does all this seem really confusing once you actually break it down and think about it?
It's extremely confusing.
It is. Well, if you have the spiritual stomach to stay with us, we're going to pause and see what those people with the torches and pitchforks outside the studio want. And hopefully at least some of us will return with part 3 of episode 60 of God Beyond the Bible.
And welcome back to segment 3, assuming you've stuck around for segment 3 of episode number 60 of God Beyond the Bible, and our topic today is salvation.
Well, and let me go ahead and say before I do this little first part of it is, these questions are important for all of us to ask ourselves no matter where we stand on this evangelical thing, because these are the questions the people we are told we are supposed to convince, these are the questions they're going to have. And me, just to be perfectly honest, our set answers that we have, our apologetics and set answers that we have aren't satisfying.
No.
They're very satisfying to the, in the lingo of the church community, but they're not very satisfying, into my opinion. Saying, that's just my opinion.
Are you saying to those of us who speak Christianese?
Yeah.
That's my new favorite word.
Okay, in segment 1, for our own benefit and hopefully yours, we tried to break down this whole salvation issue. And in short, it's a little like yelling, run for your life. Come follow me. I know where there's a safe place. But never really explaining what or who it is we're trying to avoid.
Yeah, and in part 2, we sort of pointed that fact out by trying to identify exactly why it is that we as evangelicals have concluded that God has pronounced a sentence of peril and doom on everyone born into the human race, yet we aren't really that sure who the source of that peril is, or why all mankind might be automatically sentenced and in need of being saved from this elusive peril.
And we commented earlier that everything we believe about everything in matters of spiritual faith comes down to how we perceive God himself. In his letter to the Roman believers, the Apostle Paul presented the question, if God is for us, then who can be against us? He, Paul, went on to state emphatically that God is for us, and he proved he is for us because he spared not his own son.
That's right.
Now, this is a statement with far-reaching implications and is powerfully encouraging if God is perceived as stepping in and substituting his own son to pay the penalty pronounced on mankind for a wrong they have been found guilty of committing. However, this loses a great deal of its powerful meaning if it's at the same time we declare that he, God, is the one that pronounced the perilous sentence to begin with, or in short, he saves us from himself.
Yeah. And you know, this is the conundrum that the organized evangelical church has created for itself by elevating a single collection of writings to the level of divine, then formulating this interpretation and embracing this doctrine and promoting it as our foundation for everything we do. It doesn't matter how we present it. We are portraying God as being against us as mankind. And did you ever think that Paul was implying that if God is against us, then we have no hope? I mean, after all, he is God.
Well, call it simple-mindedness if you will. But how do you square that with the words of Jesus in John 3:16? When he said, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believeth on him shall not perish, but have everlasting life.
And let me go ahead and insert something right here. One of you guys showed me, maybe, or told me about, or showed me something that someone had written, that we're not to take the words in this woman's belief. We were not to put more
emphasis
or authority mm-hmm. on the words Jesus spoke than we are any of the other part of the Bible. In other words, didn't she say?
Yes.
Wasn't that
yes,
someone
yes.
who said she that we
said,
read?
She said, don't put the words of Jesus over the words of Paul.
Yeah.
Now that's something with which I have a problem.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Is it to me?
It is.
Firstly, again, as we pointed out before, if the stakes were so high that they were about eternal punishment, the conscious, now I'm talking about everlasting, yes. eternal torment and punishment. I think we've missed it. As we said, if you listen to our hell episode on hell, I think we've made that to mean something it really doesn't mean. But anyway, if they were so high that they were about eternal suffering, torment and punishment, the conscious soul suffering and writhing in a tormentuous supernatural heat, and knowing that this would become the most remembered statement that he would ever make, don't we think that Jesus himself would have set the record straight right here?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And some will argue that's exactly what he did. It's heaven or hell that he's speaking of. But that isn't what he said at all.
No. First, he assured his audience that God is love. Note, he didn't merely say God loves, but God so loved. You know, that indicates a love that transcends the moment that they're living in, that he has always loved, contrary to how so often by their Jewish influence, his father had been portrayed as calloused and angry.
Then Jesus says, motivated by his love for humanity, God gave his son. Pause for just a moment and listen to what he actually said, instead of listening to what the modern church doctrine claims. Mm-hmm. He said, God gave, not that he is going to give. He
right.
gave. And remember who's speaking here. It's his son that's speaking, and he is speaking as if he has already been given. But this is associated with the thought that he loved. Just as his love reaches all ages through all periods of time, so does the gift that he gave.
Very well put.
Very well.
And then continued, Jesus did, those that believe. And a lot of effort has gone into narrowing that broad statement into something that is restricted to the church's sanctioning of what or who qualifies mm-hmm. as whosoever believeth. But the result is what we're interested in. Whosoever believeth in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. Isn't it amazing that we can become so indoctrinated that we can't even read or hear what is actually being said, but instead we substitute what we think the person meant for what he actually mm-hmm. said, and that's dangerous when it comes to Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
He said the stakes were this, perish. He didn't even insinuate suffer eternally in a supernatural torment. He said perish, and this is a proper English translation of that Greek word that means to cease to exist.
Yeah, and you know, and then he backed it up with, but instead of perishing or ceasing to exist, the believer has eternal or everlasting life. He loves us so much that he wants us to experience a conscious immortality in place of ceasing to exist. No conscious existence.
And Trayson, I guess that leaves the conclusion to you.
Oh.
Or have you already quit? You want me to do it?
You go ahead.
Okay. We are at the place and time that we must, for our own personal peace of mind and spirituality, step back from the rhetoric and the whole crazy system that man has erected around the Bible, and the modern church's claim on having God all figured out and neatly wrapped up in a single package, and ask ourselves the difficult but important question, have I gotten the true image of who God really is? Have I allowed my instinct of self-preservation to be exploited into accepting a substitution for a true personal relationship with this exceeding great force of good and love so generically referred to as God? We are on the cusp of something much greater than yes. Luther's Reformation. We may just be experiencing that spiritual revolution.
And again, as always, may God's peace, grace, and love be on you and in you and radiate out from each of you, our fellow seekers, from all of us here at God Beyond the Bible. Did you enjoy listening to God Beyond the Bible? Do you have an idea for an episode? Connect with us today. visit our website at godbeyondthebible.com, all one word, or send us an email at email@godbeyondthebible.com, or you can visit us on Facebook. Just type God Beyond the Bible into the search bar.